and Mary. It was probably a decade ago we first started hanging out a bit in the Church of Glebe when I was in Glebe, and I can't remember who it was, but it was John Hurt or someone, or might have been Ian Packer. He said, you should really join the Anabaptist. So I really want an Anglican rector as part of the Anabaptist network, and they say it's a pretty broad church. You know? So it's been nice to be part of Fellow Travels. And the other connection with Mark and Mary is I started my sort of research into restorative justice, what I did probably, was that 2008? We had a conference together early in my research. So Mark and Mary have sort of seen the beginning and end of this journey, and tonight I'm not going to bore you with all that I've researched and thought about, but I guess in light of the kind of things we continually are confronted by in our world, things like Don Dale and those awful images of those Aboriginal boys in detention there in the Northern Territory, last week's Nauru files, and for many of us, the awful treatment of those seeking asylum, but again, particularly children. The whole question of how do we have communities that are committed to both justice, which I think most of us are committed to, but also done in a restorative way. Howard Zaire, who's often regarded as the grandfather of restorative justice for those who know the field, once said that most communities are not sufficiently robust enough to do the work of restorative justice. And so what I want to try and do tonight is look at what makes a community able to do that restorative work. There's lots of things happening out there, some of them not in an overtly Christian sense. I want to look at them and what we can learn from them. I'm going to do that fairly briefly. And then do two other things. So I think there's a distinct role for the followers of Jesus Christ in terms of building restorative communities, and then look particularly at from within the Radical Reformation tradition, particularly some of the work of John Howard Yoder that I think is a particular contribution from within the Radical Reformation. So that's what I'm going to do. For those who've heard me speak before, I work best when I get interrupted. So I'm about to teach a residential class in Canberra. We'll go for 2 days. So I probably can't speak quite for 2 days without stopping, but I'm good for 2 days, so that's a warning. So don't let me get ahead of steam up. Jump in with your particular form of restorative justice work. It's actually one of the ones that's gaining a little bit of traction and momentum in New South Wales, which is great because, unfortunately, of all the states in Australia, New South Wales is one of the ones often being way at the back of the pack in terms of implementing restorative justice in a public policy. Still not a lot happening, but it's gaining some traction. So, and it sort of introduces this concept of what a restorative community looks like. So we'll just watch this. It goes for about 3 or 4 minutes. If there's any questions, we can do that. Then I'll jump in with what I want to say. So this is about restorative communities, and hopefully...
Our prison system is broken and needs to be fixed. Each year, the money government spends on prisons keeps growing. Despite this, the number of people being locked up is also rising. In the last 15 years, prison budgets have tripled. The average number of people in jail each day has nearly doubled. Prisons are costing us a lot of money, but they aren't working that well. We need a new approach that helps make communities safer without sending so many people to jail, especially Aboriginal people. Only 3% of Australia's population is Indigenous, but they make up more than 1 in 4 adults in prison. Over half of all young people in detention centres are Aboriginal. Justice Reinvestment, or JR, has a different way of looking at prisons. JR believes government is pouring lots of wasted money into locking up offenders in jails located outside their communities. Through JR, some of this money is spent instead inside the communities, where offenders live, to reduce the number of people going to prison. JR aims to build stronger communities, not more prisons. Prisons can't do much about why people break the law, but communities can. People offend because of problems such as not having money or a job, families not taking good care of each other, drinking and drugs. Sending someone to prison doesn't fix these problems. It can actually make them worse. This means people can go back into jail many times. JR brings everyone in the community together to think about how to break this cycle. Local services, community members, and government agencies like schools, police, and magistrates all share their ideas about why this is happening. They look for clues in the community and in the justice system. Using this information, they draw up a plan to help keep more people out of prison. This plan can include community-based programs or services that will address the reasons for offending. It might also aim to change the way the justice system works. The community may find out that lots of people are breaking the law because of problems with alcohol, for instance. It might also learn that when sentencing these offenders, the court has nowhere to send them except jail. It could then decide to set up a centre to help people cut back on their drinking. The court can send offenders to this centre instead of to prison. This means less offending and fewer people going to jail. The community tests one or two of the ideas from its plan to see if they will keep people out of prison and how much money this can save government. If one young person stays in the community for a year instead of being locked up, government will save close to $500,000. The community then talks to government about using prison funds to put its full JR plan into action. Once things are in place, the community keeps an eye on how it is working and whether any changes are needed. In other countries, JR has helped to slow down prisoners flooding into overcrowded jails. It works because it makes good sense. Spending money on taking offenders away to jail pulls people out of schools and jobs, breaks up families, and weakens communities. This fills our prisons with more offenders. JR keeps people out of prison by giving community the resources they need to find local solutions to local problems. This makes them stronger and safer.
Okay, now I don't want to talk the whole night about that in particular, but that gives you a bit of a sort of feel and a pictorial for the kind of thing we're talking about. It can be community-based. In fact, it can be bigger than that. I'm currently involved with a group of a range of people in Canberra to make Canberra Australia's first restorative city. Hull in the UK was the world's first restorative city. There's been a few in America since, and in post-genocide Rwanda, four whole villages have become restorative villages. So it can be scaled up or down, but that gives you a little bit of a feel for the kind of thing we're talking about tonight, and justice reinvestment is just one particular approach. And not necessarily the best one, I just think that's a nice little pictorial image of trying to get a sense of what it's about. Does anyone want to ask any questions about what we're talking about tonight? Is it still not particularly clear? Or any other examples you may have heard that you're bringing to the table, into the room, things you've seen, experienced? In
terms of restorative, whole kind of cities and things being restorative cities, are you referring specifically to the criminal justice system?
No, so when a whole city, it would certainly impact how juvenile justice and criminal justice is done, but also in terms of government departments, their employment and HR practices. Obviously, private companies can't be forced to, but private companies are invited to adopt more restorative practices, schools, particularly public schools. So it really is a citywide approach, so there is consistency across the whole network, and certainly the conversations I've been involved with in Canberra, it's a wide representation of people from business, education, government, yes, justice.
I'm from Canberra.
Okay, great.
And I'm the executive officer of the Law Reform Commission down there. And we've been given a reference on the the restorative city stuff. So I'm right. really excited to meet you.
Yeah, great.
And I went over a few years ago to Whanganui and less often ago, whatever, last year, I went to Nova Scotia to see what they were doing in Halifax and everything like that.
Yeah, that's another one, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. And I mean, the Attorney General has said that he wants to take as the priority areas at the moment health and...
Health's another obvious one, yeah.
...and child protection,
yeah.
Which are areas which really do need a restorative approach and a relational approach. So. It's very exciting to see you. I'm sorry, I'm
fucking available. Yeah, no, it's great. So, yeah. And certainly, yes, I should have mentioned Nova Scotia. Very important, particularly because I've been part of the Commonwealth, a similar sort of... So I know the Canberra model is looking very much at what's happened there and drawing resources down from that. Okay. Anyone else want to jump in at this early point? Yes.
That's the thing that we've implemented in the Court system.
Yep.
So, and it's working really well, but we need to push it on.
Yeah, and I think that's how Zez's point, that these practices around restorative justice that I've also been involved with are great, but they need a strong community for them to be embedded in to really get the value out of them. And so, you know, the Koori courts are great, but what if the whole community organises itself around those sorts of principles and practices and not just when people get on the wrong side of the law? It's kind of the idea. So, yes, there's Koori courts, obviously, a very critical part of it. But again...
Can you bring
Koori
for
you? No? Yep, please. No, you go. I'm not going to tell you what a Koori court is. You tell us.
Yeah. it's when young offenders it's circle sentencing. So it's where before they see a judge or go into actual court, they go through the Koori court system where there's two elders or community leaders that are sitting in the circle and coming up with ways that this child does not need to go through court, ways in which we can support him to not reoffend.
So one of the basic principles of a restorative justice approach is bring together not just the offenders but victims and their supporters and other key figures within the community. So elders, it may be the magistrates of the court system, it may be other community members who've been impacted, and together as a circle, as a community, talk about what's happened, what harm's been caused, and what needs to happen to make things right. And sometimes circle processes, there you go. Yeah, there's a whole lot of resources that Mark and Mary got on the table, sir, and I've brought some of them there. The little book series that Howard there was involved in getting, there's a whole range of different applications there, from Chris Marshall's Biblical Justice one, and then a whole range of applications, circle sentencing. And the most recent one from... Judah Ushon. The most controversial application of this clearly is in terms of domestic violence. And Judah's done a good job in a very nuanced way in which it can be, it doesn't have to be, a valuable way for people who have been victims of domestic violence to actually find healing and become survivors. But there's a lot of controversy around the application for obvious reasons. And so I just need to be really careful saying its application. So that's the space we're talking about. And really what I want to talk about tonight is beyond those sort of restorative justice practices, what kind of communities, how do we think about communities that can be strong enough, robust enough to actually support these practices? Because some of the research, some of the evidence and some of the negative sort of pushback on restorative approaches has been... is often the communities, which are not strong enough, actually can end up doing more harm than good. And one of the questions often raised about victims being re-victimised through the process. And for me, that's just an obvious example of a not very strong community that can allow that to happen.
Also, sometimes the perpetrators are damaged afterwards as well. There's not been the support there.
Exactly. So what I want to do to begin with is to look at, and I'm going to use my so-called secular restorative communities. And what I mean by that is they haven't been particularly founded on distinctly Christian principles or approaches. So I'm going to carve out a space where I think Christians have a role in this, and then particularly on what I want to get to is the role of the Radical Reformation tradition. Now, some of these people I know personally, some have a faith commitment, so I just want to be really careful when I say secular. What I'm talking about, their applications in the world, and not necessarily, you don't need to be a Christian, they don't come necessarily from Christian roots, although some of them I think you can see them. So the first, David, David I know, I'm not sure David would call himself a person of faith, but he's certainly someone who has great respect and empathy for the church and the role it's been. And his role has been particularly in organisations and helping organisations work with conflict in a way that the whole organisational culture is transformed. So not just that sort of mediation or specific instance of conflict resolution, but how do you have an effective organisation that deals with stuff. The two things he's done that have been really helpful is a whole lot of information obviously around what David's work, but two things I think really helpful: the importance of fair process for a restorative community, that if people are going to buy in, they've got to say, yeah, this looks fair, both for victims and offenders and for the supporters of victims of offenders and for people who are more neutral, whether that's the courts or the elders or whoever. People need to say, yeah, this process looks fair. And then the incorporation of genuine conversation. Unless people have a chance to sit down and talk and listen, it's not going to go very far. So that's been really helpful, some of David, and David's actually one of the early pioneers of restorative justice in Australia, and his work and research has been very important. I've got a reference there if you want to look up. It's getting a bit old now, but that's because he's one of the pioneers. Now, one of the challenges, I think, to David's work or anything that's based just on fair process and good conversation is that of French philosopher Paul Ricoeur, who one of his critiques of contemporary society is he says, courts only work when you have a judge who's able to ultimately make a judgment. You take a judge out of the court and what you have is endless deliberation. And he said, our whole culture in a way has become like a court without a judge. We have endless deliberation about things, but no one's ever prepared to make a judgment. He said, take judgments out and you have no justice. Judgment there, he means determination, not condemnation, that other sort of sense of coming to a determination. And he saw that one of the risks of simply getting people down and talking is you just go round and round, and you've all been part of meetings like that, and particularly where an important thing's on, you need to come to a resolution. This young person or these victims, their future is at stake here. Something needs to be decided. And if all you do is go round and round and round and there's no ability to discern and make good judgments, that's a problem. So that's one of the questions we need to ask. Where does the community learn how to do discernment well? Where does a community learn to make good and right and proper judgments? Welcome, come on in. I think we can widen the circle. We widen the circle. And
Does that need
for
judgment require a judge?
Traditional Western systems of judgment say yes. More restorative practices say there may be a way that a community's judgment is actually more powerful, more effective. So I don't think it needs to be an individual, but that judgment needs to happen is, I think, Ricoeur's point. So yes, I don't think it needs to be located in one individual, although that's very much the Western tradition that we've inherited. So then we move to a second approach, and I'm using here the work of Everton Worthington III. I love authors that have that are the third. Obviously the US. And he's coming from a more therapeutic perspective. So as a trained psychotherapist in the counselling world, and he's written a number of books, you can see them there, and he condenses it down. His sort of approach And it is focused more on individuals, but he says communities and churches can embrace this in that acronym there, the sort of the recall the hurt, empathise, gift of, altruistic gift of forgiveness, commit publicly to forgive and hold on to forgiveness, is his sort of core approach, built very much around a therapeutic model of a restorative community. Again, I'm moving really quickly through these, so this is the broadest of brushstrokes. Now, what's the critique here, or what's the challenge? John McKnight has written a long time ago. He identifies a lot of, and his book's called The Careless Society. He says one of the problems we have is a lot of the caring that happened almost organically within neighbourhoods, within families, within communities, in 20th century, is right, late 20th century culture, has become what he calls allopathic. What does he mean by that? He said actually rather than building community, disperses community, because people who have a problem, quote unquote, the afflicted are isolated. So rather than saying this is a community problem, oh, you've got depression, or you're a sort of person that continually, you know, is doing the wrong thing, you've got a problem, isolating the individual, and the spirit of the expert is the main intervention. And so you can see again how McKnight just asks us some questions. The good work and those five principles I had from Worthington, they're actually worth hanging on to, because they do describe what needs to happen for many people, for forgiveness and justice to be sort of held together in a process. So I'm not saying that's wrong, but if that's all we're doing, a purely therapeutic approach has some of these problems that I think McKnight's able to identify. I need to keep moving because we haven't even got to the Christian, haven't even got to the Radical Reformation, but I'm just trying to give you. Now we're getting probably close to the bone for particularly some of the my close Anabaptist friends here. I'm getting on holy ground here. But Jarom, who some people might know, he's got a vision for just peace community or what he's called just peace ethics. And it's more of an ethical or values-based, principles-based approach. The things I like about Jarom's work, that's the book Just Peace Ethics, he's honest about the tensions and complexity required to build communities of peace. You know, this isn't a seven step. Anyone that tries to say, here's the seven steps to having a strong restorative community is kidding you. This is hard and difficult and complex work. And he also, and I think this is probably the most valuable part of his contribution, that restorative communities for them to work involve a way of life and not just a program. And so for bureaucrats, policymakers, they're going to hate hearing that. That this is not just simply a program to be implemented over a 3-year cycle of funding and particular outcomes. We're actually talking about people's way of life, which is why it's described as an ethical approach. So as I go here, I'm getting to ones that I think are more helpful, and I think out of the three so far, Jarom's is most helpful. I've actually critiqued him a bit in my own book, and one of the critiques I have of Jarom's work is I think it, and this is really where a lot of my work comes in and what I'll say later, in the evening, there's a hesitancy in Jarom's work to draw on the life and death of Jesus and those deep roots of just peace that come from the Christian tradition, and particularly Jarom's own Radical Reformation tradition, kind of get lost. And I think that's a shame. And part of me is mystified a little bit why Jarom didn't connect the dots, because they're there. You can see who he's indebted. You can see he's indebted to Jesus as he thinks about this. You can see the authors almost, but he kind of is hesitant to actually connect the dots. Anyway, I won't go on too long about that. Then the one that I think gets closest, and clearly working out of a deep Christian commitment here and a deep commitment in the Anabaptist tradition, is that of Jean-Paul Lederach, who many people have heard of, and his work around conflict resolution, but not just, that sort of reduces it too much. Really what he wants to talk about is reconciled communities. And if you've never come across his work, then the Cheat's Way is his little book on conflict resolution. I'm not sure, is it there? It might be on the table. You got it on the table, Jean-Paul?
I didn't bring it, but I have copies.
Okay. That's definitely one to read. His longer works that are also there noted. Look, this is we're getting to some really great and profound work here.
What's the
reason? Building peace, sustainable reconciliation divides societies. Yep. A couple of things that I love about Lederach's work is that the work of reconciliation requires concrete social or public places. Reconciliation is a public good. And so, you know, the obvious example to go to here, and everyone talks about, I'm sorry, but it is obvious, the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions in South Africa. They were public, they're in front of the media. Reconciliation doesn't belong behind closed doors. And he again and again shows how that's true. And then something I think is almost close to a unique contribution, all my reading and work, though I've not seen someone isolate this. He says the best people to do this work are actually the middle-level actors. What he means by that is, he says you take your big public figures, your Nelson Mandelas, your Desmond Tutus, often they're not the ones that actually can do the work of reconciliation. You need figureheads, but often people who are military leaders or political leaders or even senior church leaders are too constrained, and they're disconnected from the grassroots where often the conflict goes. You go to the other end, people embedded in the communities, and they're actually so involved in the conflicts, it's particularly true in parts of Africa, it is so incredibly deep, that those tribal conflicts there is. If you're part of a tribe, you can't actually be a reconciler because you're so deeply embedded. It's these middle-level actors that have connections to both the top level and the grassroots. He's identified they're the ones who are actually the most effective at bringing about the work of reconciliation. I think it's fantastic.
Now, is that community-like conflicts
as opposed to individual conflicts? Yes, so we're talking about building restorative communities. So,
okay.
Yep, don't wait for the Prime Minister to turn Australia into a restorative community, but don't expect, you know, the people on the ground involved in the conflicts to be able to. It's actually middle level. And I think, you know, a lot of the spaces you and I would occupy is that middle-level actor. I think it's been a great gift he's given us here. I don't have a critique of him. I probably could think of one, but I think Jean-Paul Lederach gets closest to the kind of things we should be talking about. Before we go much further, though, I need to do just a little bit of ecclesiology with you. If Mary Fisher was here, she'd be very glad. But before we're entering the tricky terrain, and there are no obvious answers here, but I'm going to get you just to think about this. Before I say what's the role of Christians, and I guess I'm particularly of groups of Christian, the Christian community, yes, churches, but Christian organisations as well. So I don't just want to talk about the church. What's the role of Christian communities in terms of building restorative communities? We need to have some sense of these relationships. And we spend a whole 3 hours on this in the ecclesiology subject I teach. Well, I no longer teach it, but when I used to be full-time in the university, we've got about 3 minutes, so we're not going to go very long, but just have a look at those. What is the relationship between the kingdom of God that Jesus seemed to spend most of his time talking about, the world, the context which we're in, and the church, which most people are surprised to find out Jesus only mentioned specifically twice, by name, and so these things. What's the relationship? Well, anyone want to sort of venture their thoughts? Because this is really important for us. We now pivot to thinking about from those so-called secular restorative communities to distinctly Christian ones. This question is going to be in the background. We don't need to resolve it now, but we've got to get some sense of the terrain here. Sorry, there's no tests, there's no exams at the end of this, but what's the relationship? Well, you know, what is the relationship? What should the relationship be like? Is it the first time you've ever seen those three put on a page together? You've never thought about the relationship between them.
Would it be in the Lord's Prayer?
Say some more. Your kingdom come,
yeah.
Your will be done. So it seems Jesus teaches us to pray about the kingdom, not the church. Mm. Okay, so that's a bit of a pointer. Thanks, Marissa.
Yeah, I think, well, extending that we pray that the kingdom would come on earth as it is in heaven. And
yes.
Through praying that, we're committing ourselves, maybe that's too strong a word, but we're becoming part of the group that's trying to bring that about.
Yep.
That could be a definition of the church, is that we are the body that attempts to bring the kingdom of God to earth.
So kingdom and world seem pretty central in Jesus' prayer toward his disciples. Maybe a bit of a shot over bow for people like me who've spent my adult life trying to serve the church. It's easy sometimes I may have missed what Jesus taught me I should be on about.
Jesus expresses that he is
fulfillment of the Torah and prophets, and much of what they have to say is about communities and restoring communities, particularly and being the kind of community that reflects the kingdom and kingdom values, which has direct application to the world.
Yep.
And the church is a spokesperson for that.
Okay. So church is a spokesperson for the kingdom. Okay. You're actually sneaking up on, I think, what might be classically, you know, we're going to see Yoda's language is more around foretaste and herald. Mm-hmm. I think his spokesperson, that language of herald, is getting close to what Yoda was on about.
Effectively a prophetic voice.
Yes, thank you. Yep.
Demonstration.
Yeah, yep. And in the African context, they actually talk about demonstration plots. Restorative communities as demonstration plots. And I think it's a lovely, yes, it's more than just in words, it's in action.
Yeah. Claire Stewart was a,
yep.
A Baptist in the South back in the 50s and 60s when civil rights were going on, and he used that image of the church as being the demonstration plot of the kingdom,
yes.
Where you plant those kingdom seeds and then you model it for everyone else to see, and that's what the church is supposed to do.
Yep. We're going to use the word later, I might as well use it now, to capture some of that in terms of witness. Mm. Something, I'll put my hand up, my mob, I have to fess up, I'm a Sydney Anglican rector, my mob is hopeless at. We've got no clue, we don't even know how to start a conversation. We just turn into a verb, oh, you must mean witnessing. No, I don't. There's actually a long and strong tradition of the church as witness. And again, that's where I'm going to be going to in terms of, I think, some of the distinct value in the Radical Reformation perspectives. Got that a lot clearer and been much better at it than some of the bigger churches that go on a lot about mission and evangelism and witnessing. So that's where we're heading, so I'll just put that little marker up now for you.
Yeah, because that can cause a lot of radicalism, a lot of radical theories. What church should look like because they say kingdom reflected.
Mm. Yeah, well, I think it's true, you know, the you know, whether you're an Anglican or a Hillsong or something, church is almost it.
Yeah.
Like your whole focus is church,
yeah.
And what the church is doing. Mm. And this is where even asking this question, some of my students have never even thought of the three together.
In my own case, I'm not, you know, one particular church.
Yep.
I attend a few.
Yep.
There's a lot of good stuff going on. Mm. But alone, you know, I cannot really do much being alone. And no specific church suits me.
Okay.
So,
might be a few people in the room that feel like that, actually. Yep. Don't think you're alone on that one. Okay, last chance. Anything on the relationship between these three?
Just think quickly, I think the kingdom has something to do with God's mission in the world. In terms of thinking about the church and mission, I like to think about it. I think it was, I can't remember his name, great missiologist. He talked about...
Leslie Newbegin? No.
Yeah, Leslie, or... yeah, can't remember his name.
Bosch, Transformers.
Bosch, sorry. Yeah, Bosch. You know, the church not having a mission, but... kind of God having a mission of the church joining in on that in the world. And so in terms of kingdom, yeah, you can use language of witness or embodiment of that reality amidst the world.
Jesus tends to turn their concepts on their head in terms of his expressions of not lording it over the others like the Gentiles do, or I've come to serve and not be servants. And
yep.
So he uses the kingdom motive, but he flips them on his head and talks about the way in which that's enacted in the world. I think that's an interesting expression of
what
change the dynamic of those.
And what you're saying is, pick up what Shane's saying, this isn't clearly all that can or should be said. Again, I can go for a whole semester on church, but one of the ways to think about the church is at its best when it embodies, is a demonstration plot, witnesses, to the kingdom in the world. Okay? It's one of the ways to think about the relationship between these three. Obviously, the church, there's more to be said, but that's not a bad way to think about for our purposes. Now, at this point, we need to think of, and I know I'm really treading where angels should fear now, but to think about the question of Constantinianism, the big thing in the Radical Reformation. And what I want to say, just briefly, and we can continue this over supper, because I don't want people to come to me. I think there's the good, the bad, and the ugly. In terms of thinking of restorative communities, there are some, I think, undeniably good things happened when the empire became Christian, and you can read about some of them there. That infants were no longer abandoned. That was a common practice, and when the empire became Christian, that became against the law to abandon your infant. That, to me, seems an undeniable common public good, and there's a range of things there. Allowing slaves to actually worship on a Sunday, and the sort of public embrace of really a Sabbath practice. For me, an undeniable common good. So there are some things I want to say. So I'm not one of those who want to say all Constantinian, all bad. There are some things that are good. There are the bad things. And some of the bad things was the accumulation of power and wealth by the church. And this is probably where perhaps most people focus their energy when critiquing Constantinianism, is that sense of what the church, when it cozied up to power and grew in wealth, what happened. And particularly some of the tactics used by the church in silencing their rivals that continues to this day. So that's the bad. What I actually really think in terms of what we're talking about tonight is the ugly is the way churches came to see themselves. So going back to our slide, the church, the kingdom sort of receded from view, almost unimportant. And the goal through Christendom was getting people to church. So from the 4th century, the relationship was now between church and world and getting people from the world into the church. That was the goal. And what brought them? Well, things like baptisms, weddings and funerals, those rites of passages, but at other times questions of life, and what we might generally call pastoral crisis, when people were in need, whether it was a need of assistance or they were sick or lonely. That became the reason for the people in the world to come into the church. And for centuries, the church, in effect, got away with, it's probably better than that, but I'm trying to sort of, you know, be a little bit sort of setting myself up for where I want to go, but got away with being a restorative community when it was able to engage people through pastoral care, offer that safety net, when it was able to genuinely embrace people, they came to the door and take them all the way to the altar where they were full members of the church, and where it was exemplary of what I said a moment ago. To the extent the church was doing those things well, it was the place of a restorative community. I think that continued in various ways up until probably the middle of the last century. Probably never fully in Australia. Churches generally, I think. Churches generally, to the extent that they were able to be engaging, embracing and exemplary, they offered, I think, the wide Australian, what the world in Australia, let's talk about Australia, a sense of being a restorative community. I want to say in 2016, we have lost most of that. We're no longer engaging. We're certainly not embracing. In fact, we're often seen as more exclusive. And certainly with the Royal Commission going on to institutional business, that people see as far from exemplary. So part of the crisis for the churches is they're no longer able to be a restorative community, even in the way they were in a limited ways in the past.
So you're saying that stopped 50 to 100 years ago?
Sorry?
You're saying that stopped about 50 to 100 years ago?
Yeah, probably 100 too long ago. I think around the 1950s was probably the peak.
What do you think caused that?
Look, there's a whole lot of stuff we can talk about. The secularisation that happened in the 60s, you know, the student movement, a whole range of things happening. I wouldn't want to say one thing, you know, different ways of thinking, but, you know, I think I was born in 67. I don't think the church has been a genuinely restorative community in my lifetime.
Promoting community tolerance.
Yeah, and so I guess the question of ecumenical relationships is related to this, but I'm trying to talk about the church as an entity and its role. And I think individual churches still provide places of safety and refuge and can be restorative for individuals, but the church, as if I can just talk about the church as a one group, which is always difficult to do, I think we've lost that role, that function, to whatever degree, and that's contested anyway, whatever role the church had in Australian life from invasion, but it's certainly, whatever we had, we've lost ground, and we're no longer able to serve. So I think that's where we need to think about. So in a sense, if that's the way people encountered God in the church, we're now in a situation where dispersing church into the local community. And the missiologists talk about this. We can no longer operate on an attractional model. If you think people are going to come to the church and you can be restorative people and people come to church, then look around on a Sunday morning, and even the people that might have been here 30 years ago are no longer here. When I started in full-time ministry, so now I'm talking less than 30 years ago, the Twices were the people who came twice a day to church. The Twices, they're the most committed folk. The Twices are now the most committed people who come twice a month. So patterns of belonging have changed, and that's impacted the church. So the church is in crisis in thinking this through, and we can no longer just sit back and think we can be a restorative community. So we've got to go back to thinking about Jesus, the kingdom and the church as we do. And there's a whole lot of things here, but just look at the last point. It's the radical Reformation emphasis, and particularly in a believer's church, that I think holds some promise here for us. Because unfortunately too many churches, the denomination I belong to, is still in a sense working on that old, if you build it, they will come. If we can be engaging and embracing, and what was my third one? It's a little test.
Exemplary.
They will come, and we can be a restorative community. We can be a light, the light on the hill. Mm. And the reality is, we're just kidding ourselves. It ain't happening. So, where do we go? Sounds a bit depressing. Well, this is where I want to now turn. Any questions on that? Let me pause before we turn to Yoda and see what he's got to offer us. It's a bit of a whirlwind tour of a whole lot of things, but I'm just kind of setting us up now for the contribution, particularly of the Radical Reformation, in terms of thinking about what it means to be a restorative community in the world.
You said Jesus only talked about church twice.
Yes.
Explicitly. What did he say?
So Matthew 16:18. This is Petra, Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. And then a little later in Matthew 18, talking about being taking the wrongdoer before the church. So if someone's wronged you, you go in private, take two or three people, and if that doesn't work, take them before the ecclesia. The two places that the ecclesia, the Greek word for church, is mentioned in the Gospels.
So that was to seek justice?
Yes. Yeah. I think it's a good model of restorative justice, actually.
Yeah.
And I think, getting back to your question about why we can't do those three E words anymore. I think it goes back to Matthew 18, because we're not doing that in the church.
Yes.
And it's that third step. We never get to the third step because people leave the church and go shopping someplace else. There isn't that discipline to have restorative justice within our own communities. So how can we be sharing that with the rest of the world when we don't even do it in our own communities?
Yep.
And that's what Matthew 18 is about.
Yep. And as we'll see, it's what Yoda was on about. Any other thoughts or questions at this point before we dive into... Yep.
The withdrawal of the church from the world and some of that more structural and systemic issue, and just saying the faith is personalised, and then maybe overextension of Lutheran's doctrine of faith alone through grace alone, and moving away from this
So let me contain what I can say, because there's a whole lot I could say about that, but let me say it in the issue, and I think Mark was right in terms of there's wrongdoing in the church. What tends to happen is if there's any church discipline at all, wrongdoers are hounded away or stripped of leadership, and that may be appropriate. I'm not saying it's wrong, but there's sanctions of various levels. Victims are often completely ignored, and everyone else just hopes it gets back to normal as quickly as possible. So that's a specific instance of what you're talking about in this space. We have, and unfortunately to our great shame, it's been Royal Commissions that has forced the church to listen long and properly to victim stories. You know, something that should have been instinctive to our practices based on who we follow and what we believe, we've actually had the government had to come along with a big stick and say, you're going to listen. You're going to listen to these stories. That's to our shame. Unfortunately, in many of our churches, in our desire to see the wrongdoer repent and be restored, we've taken to the same approaches of justice with a big stick as the criminal justice system. Or we've done the opposite, and it's been, you know, a feather duster. You know, such light sort of, you know, that sort of... But genuine working, you know, most church pastors, you ask them, what's your approach to working with the perpetrators of domestic violence? But we know it's an issue. We, unfortunately, the focus, and it's rightly been so, we had a thing last Saturday night at my church, Larissa was out, and it was a great night, thinking about domestic violence in the church. The focus was primarily and rightly on the impact it's had on those silent victims within our churches. But there's equally a task of, and it was interesting, how many men weren't there? You know, there weren't many blokes. It's uncomfortable, blokes, to talk about this stuff, but what about the blokes that have been perpetrators of domestic violence? What's the church going to do for them? And I know most of my colleagues want to run a million miles from that question. Got no clue. But again, if we're serious about who we say we follow and what we believe, then surely repentance and faith is one of the things we'd hope for perpetrators. Obviously, whilst safety for victims. So yes, the individualisation I think is concerned on how we actually deal with wrongdoing in our midst. Charles Taylor, so you got me going. Charles Taylor, the great French Canadian philosopher, he said, in the face of wrongdoing, there are three in history, you can see three broad approaches. My enemy is to blame. He said, and that's the root of much violence in the world. He actually talks particularly about religious violence. I don't think it's just religious violence, but you can see that. If something's happened, something's gone wrong, my enemy is to blame. He said, that's a big story. He said, in the last 200 years, another story's emerged that has also got problems with it. And he said, really, from Freud onwards, and what he says the therapeutic approach, is, well, no one's to blame. So if someone's doing the wrong thing, it's because they themselves were a victim, obviously. We can't blame them because they're just caught up in this pattern. So really, no one's to blame. And he said, really, those two don't get us anywhere. They're actually quite both unsatisfactory. He said, the only genuine possibility, and again, it cites the Truth and Reconciliation, the only genuine possibility is to say somehow we're all to blame. When wrongdoing happens in a church, the first thing we should say is, how have we allowed this to happen in our midst? Not who's to blame or how are we going to fix this, but how have we allowed this to happen in our midst? And that should be the response the conversation churches are having, my church should be having, in light of things like the Royal Commission. How do we allow this to happen in our midst? But no, we are more comfortable with the blaming and the traditional kind of scapegoating, you know, the few bad eggs type stuff. You know, lets us off the hook. Now, the community takes responsibility. That's a robust community. That's a restorative community that can answer that question. So let's...
But that takes a group that's really willing to look at themselves.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's really hard to do that. Because often you can't see your own shadow side. You know, you can see everybody else's. But looking at yourselves and saying, what is it that... What in our practices and the way we relate and the way that we look at each other, you know, or deny each other, that we've allowed this to go on. You know, and that there's hurt there that we said, no, that's yours to deal with.
And it's increasingly difficult to do in a mobile world, or a transient world, where it's so easy just to pick up your bags and go somewhere else. And not to hang around to work through the hard stuff. As you say, the community, it's only going to be restored if people stay around long enough and do the hard work.
These days, it's too easy just to leave. It all assumes that we are really close to each other, and I haven't seen it anywhere in Australia. I've seen it once, real closeness in the community of Jehovah's Witnesses in India. Everybody knew of everybody, so nothing was hidden, and therefore the community can take responsibility. They see something develops, and they also have the tradition of challenging or facing someone who's doing something wrong. So it's not promoting Jehovah's Witnesses, but they have a great practice of being so close. When we are so far apart, and what do we know? What's happening there in domestic violence? How do we know?
Well, and I think added that particularly, and I'm part of this, and I'm 50 in February, but the online communities we belong to, the social space where we can construct a false reality, and if anyone challenges, we just block or unfriend them. You know, the opportunity to have those. The kind of communities where we can know and challenge each other and ask together, I think there's real challenges for us. So it's not just that sort of what you'd know, that's true, but I think increasingly we're in a space where we just genuinely don't know how to navigate some of these things. It doesn't mean we shouldn't try, but it is a real challenge.
There's a great example, and it's actually really good that today's the anniversary, but Gurindji, the community in Gurindji, of Vincent Mungari, who you know, who went against Lord Vesey, and this is a great story because he was a great Christian man, and it took a great Christian man and a great Christian church to do the Wade Hill walk off, and sometimes it means to do radical things that is against your own personal, you know, belief in that you will get the change, the radical change. So I just think that, you know, there's stuff has happened in Australia that has been radical transformation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk about 1950s being the, you know, drastic change.
Yeah.
But would you say that things were happening even in the past?
Look, I wouldn't want to say it too strongly. I do think there was a different model of neighbourhoods. So I think the other thing that's happening independently of the church, but did change the church, was the advent of the motor car and the rise of the suburbs is part of what's happening in the background. And so communities are changing. You know, you go back to my grandparents' generation and everyone engaged on their front verandas. You know, that was the meetings, that was the social space. Now you go into the suburbs, people don't even not have front verandas, they don't have front doors, there's triple-fronted garages that you secure entry and you drive in, because there's no footpaths, people aren't on the streets. And so you drive into the house and you enter the security of the house through the garage. Now that's a radical change in about two generations that has impacted the kind of neighbourhoods and therefore the way churches exist in those neighbourhoods. You know, my grandparents' generation, most people walked to church or maybe jumped on a bus. You know, there's very few churches now, and we're about to do the National Church Life Survey, where more than 50% of people either walk or get public transport to their church. Most churches are built on mobility, so the issue you said, but, you know, so that's a change that's just happened across Australia. It's had a huge impact on the churches, that in a sense is independent of student movements and 60s and all that, but it's all happening at the same time. Okay, so let me say some things about Yoda, and again, I'll park to one side the things about Yoda's own personal life, the great sadness, but it's true for many of us who risk writing, speaking, is that Yoda couldn't put into practice or submit to the kind of restorative community he so eloquently wrote about. And if you want to talk about that later, we can do that over. But I think what he said and wrote still stands the test of time. And it's a great sadness and tragedy that he was not willing to submit to the sort of restorative community. Importantly, many people know about Yoda because of Politics of Jesus. And again, plug if you've never read, it's the one book of his you should read. But increasingly he was writing about the church, particularly later in his writing career. And I think there's an important connection there. If I had time, I'd talk about others like Bonhoeffer who have a different approach, but the connection between Christology, personal work of Jesus Christ, life, death and resurrection of Jesus, and being a restorative community, again, it's tightening those connections between kingdom, church and world. And too much that's written about the church, too many people writing about the church do it independently of their Christology. And I think that's a great change. So one of the reasons I've chosen Yoda because he wrote about Jesus and he wrote about the church, and the two are connected in his writings. There are others I could have gone to, but he's the one I'm familiar with, so he's the one you're going to get. For those who are less familiar with his writings, and this is particularly taken from his book on Christology and Theological Method, a number of themes keep re-emerging. The theme of reconciliation is big for Yoda. The issue of subordination, or what he sometimes calls innocent suffering. Revolutionary subordination, I think, is the title he used in The Politics of Jesus. That's a big theme. You can see how he's getting from the person of Jesus, the work of Jesus, these big themes. The ethic of discipleship is an obvious one, particularly in the Radical Reformation tradition. And then the one about the lordship of Christ, particularly in relationship to those disarming the powers. So these are some of the big themes in Yoda's work, particularly emerging out of his Christological work. And that's going to have, I just want to note those as we go. When it gets to what that means for the church, Yoda had the threefold challenge for Christian communities. And again, I want to broaden on, I don't just want to talk about the local denomination, the local expression or the denomination, church organisations, fellowship groups, a whole lot of, you know, common grace even, as a Christian organisation, some people here, the Anabaptist Network, as a Christian community, I think they all qualify in what we're talking about. What is your true nature? What do you exist to do? What's your mission? And then how does, and this is going to be complicated theologically, but I'll try, how does what the church does intersect with what the world, and particularly the government, is doing? So he's looking at those in between what he calls the order of redemption in his language and the order of providence. If by God's providence, Romans 13, we have governments, we have the, if that's part of God, what God, the order of providence, how does the church, based in the life, death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, what he called the order of redemption, how do the two intersect? That's a really key question that often's not wrestled with. And I think, again, it comes out of his deep understanding of who Jesus was. Because in a sense, when he's writing about Jesus, he's writing about the same kind of things. How does Jesus engage with the powers of this world? That's a key question. His basic argument, we noted this earlier, the church must be, in three of his favourite words, foretaste, herald or model. Importantly, before a watching world. Come back to work at the end. The church must be a foretaste, a herald, or a model of the kingdom before a watching world. What Mark said earlier, if we're not being exemplary, if we're not engaging and embracing, then what hope do we have of being part of building a wider restorative community in our neighbourhoods, our workplaces, our cities? So he got this right. Now, note here, a lot of people like both Yoder and Bonhoeffer. I'm one of these people that likes both Yoder and Bonhoeffer. At this point, they're actually in sharp disagreement. Bonhoeffer was much more on about the church's solidarity for the world. His Christology said Jesus was the man for others, and therefore the church is the community for others. He could care relatively less about what the church was like. The church's main role for Bonhoeffer was to be in solidarity, and in his context, with the Jews, those who are at the margins. So again, this is just, and I think Yoder's got something to offer here in terms of what it means to be restorative. Here's a quote that I could spend the whole night talking about, but I'll just give it to you. Integral to the calling of the church is for it to demonstrate what love means in social relationships. So integral to the calling of the church is to demonstrate what love means in social relationships. In the community, how do we demonstrate love in action in those relationships? Whether it's your school, your workplace, whatever it is. That's the calling of the church. He then goes on to talk about then what that impact will have, what he calls the watching world. The world can imitate and be challenged by it. This is the idea of being both a herald and a foretaste. There is that prophetic challenge, but also an invitation. There's both things going on. And particularly if you see in his teaching on Matthew 18, which we mentioned earlier, this both tasks Jesus talks about, both binding and loosing. Now, Jesus said that to his disciples, that there's twin tasks, and Yoder gets that in terms of the church's role. There's two things going on here. So any thoughts on, you do a whole semester course on Yoder's ecclesiology. I've just tried to give you a bit of a glimpse of why I think Yoder, as a Mennonite within the Radical Reformation perspective, is saying something pretty profound about what's required, particularly Christians who want to be part of building the kind of communities, the restorative communities, where love is embodied, and I guess we want to say love and justice together in those relationships are embodied. Too much theology for a Friday night? Probably.
I'm wondering, how would that look, say, with the perpetrators of child abuse within the church? How would it look to show that kind of love? I think in some instances the churches have thought that they were being loving. By sheltering people.
Yes.
It's been a sort of a misguided kind of loving. Looking after their own and sheltering and thinking that was somehow going to solve the problem, moving along to another.
So let me just give it a little bit of restorative justice theory here, and then so one of the reasons for when it's appropriate to do so, bringing victims and wrongdoers together, is the person that is best placed to tell a perpetrator the full truth and impact of what they've done is the victim, if it's safe for them to do so. And you can't imagine a child doing that, but this is what happened in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You imagine an adult who was abused as a child, who's had the opportunity to be healed, who's more than a survivor, to actually tell their story of what it was like as a child to be abused by you. Perpetrators need the space to be able to hear the truth. And unfortunately, our criminal justice system doesn't do that. Most of our systems of justice don't actually provide that opportunity for perpetrators to hear the impact of what they've done. The second thing, and I think this is uniquely churches are placed to this, is the opportunity, but more than just the opportunity, the ways to actually confess and repent. You know, we hear a lot of talk in criminal justice system about recidivism rates. It's a terribly hard word to say. About reoffending. It's a huge problem. Particularly in sex crimes often. What our world is clueless about is actually how to change people's hearts and minds. But that's at the heart of repentance. Someone to say, actually, I'm going to turn around now. That's the way I was going, and I'm going to go a different way. And, you know, if I can just sort of, you know, fly the little Anglican flag for a minute. One of the great things in my tradition is part of our public worship each week, and Thomas Cranmer wrote it, is we have prayers of confession that includes both sins of omission and commission. And often it's the sins of omission that get missed, the sins of omission. You know, when I do the wrong thing by being, you know, grumpy with my wife or teenage children and maybe being a bit short and cranky with them, I can confess the sin of commission. I was grumpy, I spoke sharply to you. In a sense, that's somewhat easy to do. You know what's really hard to do? It's a sin of omission. I failed to treat you with the dignity and respect you deserve. I failed to love you as a father or husband should love his kids or stuff. And we need, the church is this place to do that. So whether it's part of the liturgy in the Anglicans, we need to, that's what a restorative community can offer. A wrongdoer, whether it's a perpetrator of, you know, child abuse or garden variety being cranky and grumpy at the end of a busy week, spaces to actually say, this is who I am, this is what I've done, and then to receive the forgiveness. And again, in our particular way of doing it, is the priest who gets up and pronounces God's forgiveness on behalf. It's one of the priestly functions. Now, different communities, Bonhoeffer would be horrified by that. So different traditions at this point have different ways of doing that, but that forgiveness is freely available is the main point. And wow, where do we get that outside the church? And sometimes we've rushed to that, we've rushed to the forgiveness. As you say, we've tried to do that without stepping through some of those things. But, you know, based here, and Yoda saw it, based on Jesus, this is what Jesus is talking about in terms of binding and loosing. This is what Matthew 18 is exactly about, these kind of practices. And that's why Yoda's right. Unless we can do this for each other, unless we get this right, how are we going to be a foretaste? How are we going to be a prophetic herald? How are we going to help build restorative communities?
Even helping people, help them have the voice to say how they've been hurt.
Yes.
Because it's, you know, being able to give them the skills to be able to say, ouch. You know, and this is why it was an ouch. Because
yep.
Until the perpetrators can hear that, then they don't even know they need to confess sometimes because they don't know. And so we even have to help people be able to speak their ouches and give them the way to do that without attacking.
Yeah, no, sorry, I was still back here. But yes, sir. One more thing that I think is really, so. And you know, there's almost a Nobel Prize in this. What motivates a wrongdoer to actually put up their hand and say, yep, I was in the wrong. You know, I need to confess. I want to be forgiven. If we can solve that for the criminal justice system, if we can solve that for workplace disputes, if we can solve that from the boardroom to the bedroom, you know, we're confident. If we can actually get, you know, people who are doing the wrong thing to actually, you know, the world will change. But again, and this is in my book, but I just want to, what that second wrongdoer on the cross, the one in Luke's gospel says, the two guys, one who says, you know, save yourself and save us in the process. Second guy says, hang on. We're getting our just deserts here. We've been condemned. We did the wrong thing. This guy's done nothing wrong. Yeah? You remember what he said next? We turned to Jesus. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. Now, just think about that for a minute. It's normally victims who want to be remembered because they fear that no one's noticed that what's happened to them. It's actually wrongdoers who benefit most from short memory or poor memory. Wrongdoers normally gain nothing from being remembered. Most wrongdoers hope, first of all, done the wrong thing, no one notices. And if they do, they'll quickly forget. That's what you hope. When you're doing the wrong, you hope, A, no one notices, and if they do, they'll quickly forget. Why on earth would this guy say, remember me? And the story doesn't tell me, but I think I can get close. Has he heard this Jesus pray just a few minutes earlier, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do? I'm guessing he did. Text doesn't tell me, but he's there hanging behind. Midst all the cacophony of whatever happens in a crucifixion scene, his own existential angst, his own personal agony, his own broken body, he hears forgiveness being prayed. He looks and sees this inscription. Here is the King of the Jews. And his apostles are just possibly thinks, if it's true this guy's a king, there's a kingdom ruled by forgiveness and mercy. Actually, that sounds all right to me. I want in. That's how I interpret his it. If you are a king and your kingdom is ruled by forgiveness and mercy, then please count me in. Please remember me when you come into your kingdom. It's the first person in Luke's gospel that uses Jesus' name. And we know what Jesus means in the original. Yeshua, the one who saves. And in Acts Gospel, the second part, it is by the name of Jesus you'll be saved. Jesus, remember me. Actually, at the heart of our tradition is actually the way we can actually do what you asked about. How do wrongdoers, perpetrators, actually fess up? It's by them knowing, understanding, believing, trusting that there is a kingdom ruled by forgiveness and mercy and wanting to be remembered as part of that kingdom. How many of our churches, Yoda would ask us, are foretastes, heralds, models, demonstration plots of kingdoms of mercy and forgiveness? Unfortunately, my take is, and I've spent most of my adult life working for churches, most of the churches, I'm embarrassed to say, that I've pastored, that I belong to, are full of unforgiven and unforgiving people. We talk a good forgiveness game, but when it actually comes to the practices, which again, what Yoda's on about, the Radical Reformation, it's actually our internal practices. One of the essay questions we have for the first year students in ecclesiology is a quote that comes from Stanley Howis. It's the first task of the church is to be the church. And they're asked to discuss that. But it's kind of right, isn't it? Unless we can be in the church business ourselves, what chance do we have of convincing anyone else by our witness, by our words? And so if we could actually become genuine places of forgiveness, of reconciliation, where justice is still done. Now, I need to finish probably soon. One of the things, one of the dangers, let me say, of restorative communities is that justice gets lost. So restorative practices in schools, I've been involved in them, the justice language has disappeared. And it's not just a language issue. Some people who know I've been involved in restorative justice say, you know, that's a crock. My kid was bullied. You know what the teachers did? They got him in a room with all the bullies and they let him talk about it. Like, how is that meant to help? And so restorative practices simply become circles where people talk and justice isn't done or seen to be done. We've got a problem. And that's a whole other conversation about how to keep both a restorative community where forgiveness and mercy reign but where also justice is done. And again, I'd point to what happens on the cross, but that's a whole other conversation. I'm not going to even start there. How are we going, Shane? Are we 8:30? I've been going an hour and a half. Wow, see, I told you I was good for a few 3 hours. I've got one more clip. When I teach the ecclesiologists, the clip I show to show what does the church look like is from the film Witness. Anyone seen the film Witness? The old times, all Harrison Ford, set in an Amish community? How many? Okay, it's worth seeing. You young ones, this is a 1986 Harrison Ford movie. It's a long, complicated story. He's a cop. He ends up living with this Amish community. This scene, the barn raising scene, and it's in foreign language because I ripped it off YouTube, I think is not just an image of the church, it's an image of a restored community and a restorative community. So we're just going to watch this and then we can have some more questions. Maybe have a break for tea, coffee, and then have more question and answers. This is our witness. Hang on.
The music's pretty good. As I say, it's foreign language, so I
like your one of those lights.
Thank you. jeder macht sich für seine Gedanken über dich und den Engel in der Burg.
Und das ist nur gültig, da bin ich sicher.
Nein, komm, welche davon.
Okay, beyond the sort of, you know, gendered roles and quaintness of much of that, there's just so much to love about that as a foretaste and image of what a restorative community looks like in terms of the collaboration, the working together, the rolling for everyone. For a particular common good, young couple just got married or stopped at the end and a new barn for them raised in a day. And again, that's... It's part of what the Radical Reformation tradition has to offer, that sort of sense of strong communities, internal practices that Yoda talked about, to a watching world. I could say some more, and I think some of, you know, the critiques I'd offer is the world watching anymore? Anything particularly of the Amish, you know, people go there as a curiosity now. Only time in my recent memory is of the story of the Amish community forgiving someone, and the film was made of that. So the world took notice then, so it still happens. But one of the questions is, in terms of Yoda's approach, you know, is the world actually watching any longer? So that's a challenge, maybe. But let me finish there, Shane. We'll have a tea and coffee, then more Q&A or Q&A now. I'm in your hands. I'll stop.
Yeah, maybe we can have a few minutes break, just grab some nibblies and tea and coffee and come back and have a time of discussion.